Everyone, we are back. Welcome to our second episode of Healthcare AI for Dummies. This is a monthly podcast with industry luminaries talking about new trends in healthcare AI. I am very excited to present my guest today. I'm here with Dr. David Ru from Microsoft. I'm also here with the very well-known Fouad Butt, formerly at Kaiser Permanente and United Healthcare, Optum. Let's start off, we have a lot to talk about today. Let's start off a little bit with just getting to know both of you so that our listeners kind of fully understand where you're coming from in this conversation. David, let's start with you. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your current role at Microsoft, where you've been and what you're doing in Gen AI to start out with?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm super excited to be here. My name is David Ru. I'm the Global Chief Medical Officer for Microsoft. Been in healthcare technology for the past 30 years. I'm a physician, a health services researcher, a technologist. I spend a lot of my time thinking about how technology improves health outcomes, specifically access to care, quality of care, patient safety, finding ways that we can improve the overall efficiency of care and improve the experiences for both patients and providers. My role at Microsoft is to work very closely with our clients and our partners as we start exploring how these technologies, and in particular, artificial intelligence, can be applied in a healthcare setting to be able to help achieve those outcomes.
Great. Lots going on at Microsoft right now in this area. Very excited to dig in. Fouad, I think a lot of people already know you. You've certainly been around and you've written big checks to a lot of the startups in the industry. Tell us a little bit about your career and where you've been and what you're up to.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Missy and team. My name is Fouad Butt. I am a stealth founder right now, so I can't really talk about that too much. Historically speaking, I've spent the last few years in venture for a firm called Canvas Ventures. Prior to that, I was the chief data officer for Optum. Before that, I was the chief data and analytics officer for UHC, United Healthcare, the insurance business. And then prior to that, I was the chief data officer at Kaiser Permanente. So I've spent a ton of my time and career helping companies, large enterprises in healthcare, understand which data they have, how to use it, how to protect it, how to make sure that it gets the most value that's possible. So with this advent of Gen AI, I think the data piece is becoming even more critical. We used to always say data is the new oil, but I think now we're starting to see the value of this oil skyrocket as the industry adopts more LLMs.
And just to get a little bit more clarity, David, can you just sort of talk about what your purview is as you know, in your global role at Microsoft, and specifically how it relates to some of the AI functions commercially that we're seeing in the market? And then Fouad, I'll loop back to you in a minute.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have recognized is that many folks are excited over artificial intelligence. They're trying to figure out how to utilize it. So the challenges that we see are really around helping to identify the appropriate use cases. There are some products that Microsoft or some technologies that Microsoft offers. There's some that our partners offer, and it's important to kind of figure out how they all fit into a workflow. We find also the need to be able to address the need to have responsible AI, to be able to ensure that people feel that we've addressed issues around transparency, bias, drift, that we are looking at the value that it's creating, trying to figure out how you implement it. And so these elements that surround AI, in particular the data, the implementation, are so essential. And so I spend my time not just talking about artificial intelligence, but really about everything that supports it and allows it to be something that people can utilize. And at the end of the day, we want to get value out of it. We want to be able to demonstrate that it's working, that we have trust in it, and it's going to require more than just simply having great technology.
So you're working with a lot of buyers out there. You're working with large healthcare systems, payers, right? International entities.
Yes. Globally, providers, payers, pharma, life sciences, med tech, add retail into that as well. And then with the pandemic, I've had a lot of kind of interaction and I'd say interest from government agencies. You know, government agencies could be themselves the payer, like, you know, a Department of Health, but also they are in charge of defining policies for their organizations. And so working with regulators and other key stakeholders is a big part as well. So it's the whole ecosystem.
Very familiar with that. Fouad, give us a little bit of a window in when you were either at Kaiser or United Optum. Like, what is a chief data officer? Like, how big are your teams? What was your budget? Like, what size of data are we looking at? And we'll get into governance, and we'll get into some of the ways in which private industry and government and some of the new organizations that are sprouting up, Chai and so forth. So we'll get into that later. But tell us a little bit about, just so that our listeners understand the point of view that you guys are going to come through when we get into the conversation about Gen AI.
Yeah, look, you know, chief data officers come in all flavors, and they and the role comes in all sizes. I would say at Optum, it was perhaps the largest one, maybe even globally, that I had seen, in the sense that this included all capabilities around platforms, all data platforms, all data capabilities, all data quality, warehousing, so forth, as well as a lot of the tooling. So the total number, the team was in many thousands, and the budget was in many hundreds of millions. In fact, you know, for my team, we weren't really just a cost center. We were actually also a profit center, in the sense that a lot of the tools and technologies that we built was then resold to other hospitals and entities around the U.S. So quite a large number. I mean, I would say the number that I could probably share with you is that the profitability that we generated was generally around $300 to $500 million a year, more closer to the 500 million mark.
And you had how many lives at any one of those jobs that you were sort of covering, right, in data?
Look, at the United had about 60 million lives. And then prior to that, I'd been at Kaiser, which was another 12 million lives. So I jokingly say I've seen 72 million lives worth of data.
Right.
Health data, finance data, claims data, prior authorization data, you name it. You know, I've had the privilege and the responsibility to deal with it.
Well, it is great having both of you here, because clearly Microsoft their platform is used extensively in healthcare. And, you know, I've worked at both Google and Amazon, and I know the formidable vertical fences that are up around healthcare and Microsoft, and they've got some great stuff. So you both have seen a lot of data. Let's start talking a little bit about this new wave of what we're seeing: a lot of startups, a lot of point solutions, a lot of companies that are getting some venture funding right now in what we would call this sort of next generation Gen AI healthcare space. Some of these companies are focused on more of the last mile of delivery, and we're seeing them more at the co-pilot agent kind of point solution, where they're trying to go at incumbents that are already in place. Others are really focused more on large language models and trying to refine there. Talk a little bit about how you would categorize this nascent, new sort of burgeoning area that we're starting to see in tech. And like, what are you the most excited about now? And have you seen a company that's recently got funded that you really would like to have a commentary on?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I'm really excited about is the fact that we're starting to think beyond simply structured data sets, that we're looking at things that go beyond what normally requires a lot of people to fill out surveys, enter things into a standard format, but just things like our conversation, our voice, images, videos. You know, that's super exciting, because it gets to the whole point of one of the biggest barriers, which is having people fill out surveys and enter data into a system. And if we can go beyond that and start thinking about how the computer, the artificial intelligence, can capture that, then we can do a lot of different things. So like, one of the companies that I'm rather bullish on is this company that is looking at how it can use voice as a biometric. And it allows us to be able to determine, based on the voice parameters, whether or not a person is depressed or anxious, and it allows you to be able to monitor disease. I think that that's a fantastic idea. Obviously, you know, Microsoft / Nuance has offerings in the ambient clinical intelligence space. But if you're capturing the voice already for the conversation, you can then seamlessly start doing analyses of, you know, whether a person is actually having depression or anxiety and things like that. So to me, it's like, the more that we can make this frictionless, that you don't ask people to fill out forms and do things, that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, I would actually agree with you 100% on that. I think, look, there are lots of exciting things on the clinical side. I think the holy grail of AI in clinical, we still have to explore. We still have to understand. I think everybody is excited about it, but there are also a lot of risks in that space. So I see a lot of companies coming into the clinical space straight, trying to use LLMs. And my general reaction is like, I don't know if we want to start there. But I do think that's where the holy grail is. I think that's where the real opportunities, where AI meets outcomes, will happen. I'm actually also very excited about non-clinical and administrative use cases. As somebody that's spent a lot of time in the back office of healthcare and its data, I can assure you there's plenty to be done there. There are so many opportunities for efficiencies that are, you know, and I like that area, one, because it's redundancy, it's reduction in cost, in overall, it also creates a lot more fluidity in the system if you take some of that friction out. So I'm excited about some of those areas. And I think that's something where you have room to experiment and make mistakes without it being fatal. And I think that's, you know, the other thing I would say, Missy, to your broader question, what we're seeing, I think what I'm seeing is a lot of appetite for experimentation. Mm-hmm. People wanting and needing to do things that they think could be use cases in this space. Not a lot of people going straight to production, but a lot of people trying to experiment and finalize and fine tune the use cases that they're comfortable with.
You know, Missy.
Yeah, I mean, David, would you know that? Yeah.
I was just going to add on top of that, because I think one of the things that we have recognized is that, you know, when we see a problem, we say, oh, we have technology to solve that. And oftentimes it's about just solving a problem. But I think with the technology we have today, this is a transformational opportunity. We could actually look at really big problems that traditionally don't have a point solution. But with process redesign and leveraging some of these newer technologies, we could potentially address them in ways that we could never have envisioned. I'll give you one example. Access to affordable healthcare. Okay, so like one would say, well, that's an impossible problem to solve. Technology can't solve that. It's money. Well, yes, that's probably one part of it, a very important part. But what if we could actually think about how we redesigned healthcare where care was not delivered always in a hospital or a clinic, but we could actually have it delivered outside of the hospital in a facility that people go to all the time. It's in your shopping center, your mall. And we have that ability. When a person gets their eyes checked, there's a DICOM image that's taken of your eye. We could run AI on top of it. We could assess for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hyperlipidemia, a whole series of things. We have the capabilities today to be able to do so much more. And we can make it affordable. We can make it accessible. And it'll impact the people the most who actually have the least access to healthcare today. And that's like exciting, you know, to be able to think about how we could completely transform that type of process with AI as a centerpiece.
Yeah, I mean, if I could, like, I know you probably have more questions, but I think one of the things that I'm super excited about is that there's a capacity problem in the U.S. healthcare system on the supply side. And that is something that is not going to be solved overnight. But I think the AI capabilities could help us get there. I think that's an area where there's tremendous opportunity. I also think that, look, you know, if we could reimagine healthcare, which is kind of what we're trying to do here, we would see an efficient system. An efficient system is like a stock market. You have a spot price for everything. You know, we're nowhere close to that. There's so much capacity that we see on a regular basis being wasted in healthcare that I think if was utilized could yield really good results without us having to invest anymore. I joke about this, but I think I asked a friend of mine, when are we going to have a spot hero for healthcare, right? Yep. But the spot hero sells all these empty spots, parking spots that garages have that usually would have gone, you know, unutilized at a discounted price. Why aren't we doing that with some of the healthcare services? So I think there's a lot to evolve towards. And I think capacity is one of the areas that we're going to need in place to evolve.
Yeah, it reminded me, there are so many inefficiencies in healthcare. And one of the inefficiencies is just simply around, I'll call it load balancing or triage. So like when you think about like what happens all the time, and this is actually a problem that, you know, we have seen with the NHS. If you were to ask them what their number one issue is, it's about patient wait times. And why is it? Yeah. Well, there's many factors, but one of them is that when a person signs up for a total hip replacement, for instance, they get referred to a facility that is probably the tertiary care facility that's in your area. And if you were to actually look around that area, there are many facilities that could have done the procedure, but there's no wait time. It's almost like if you went into a shopping center and you saw there was one line and everyone's all in this one line, and then there's all these other open lines and no one's there directing people to these open lines. Well, AI can do that. And it's actually quite amazing that we have these problems within healthcare, but it I guess when you think about it, it's not totally unexpected.
Well, so I love the description of the problem and some of the moonshots around solving them. I think what would help our listeners, remember this is healthcare AI for dummies, right? These are people that are sort of new to the AI tech scene. So maybe let's start with like, hey, there's a ton of foundation models out there. If a buyer, someone on the payer side or someone on the health system side, or even a digital health company wants to start thinking about introducing AI into their current product offering, is there going to be one dominant foundation model out there for healthcare? How do you get started? Fawad, I know you have lots of opinions on this. Like, why don't you start? Like, break
well,
it.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Look, so I think this industry and AI in general is going to go through some cycles that we've seen before, right? I sort of compare it to the cloud. When cloud first became a normal thing, everybody thought you just get rid of all your in-house teams that manage infrastructure because now you have this managed service and as such, you don't need that. Guess what ended up happening? We ended up having to build cloud ops because cloud becomes something that you need to manage holistically by itself. We saw that with data ops. I think we're going to see that with LLM and Gen AI as well. But I think to your first question, which is there going to be a single model? I just don't think so. I just don't think that healthcare, in the US could be solved by a single model that can handle clinical, non-clinical payments, back office, authorizations, regulatory. I also don't know if we need a single model to be that intelligent, because with a big model like that comes cost in terms of bloatedness, in terms of inefficiency on compute, in terms of response times. So my belief is that the world around healthcare AI is going to evolve with many folks and many entities creating models that are of value. But I think longer term, these models turn into more agents. And then the value comes in when you plug these agents together. So somebody could build a prior authorization module, but then somebody could build a claims module. Well, if you do both of them separately, you're kind of wasting a lot of time and energy. But if you could sort of workflow those together, I think you would have a more efficient AI, you'd have more efficient outcomes. So that's kind of how I see the world, is evolution through stepped approach, not through revolution and a single healthcare model.
David, Microsoft's not running at this. You're not going to have one exclusive flavor for healthcare. It will be one foundation model that you want to use.
I think it's very consistent with what Fawad was saying. Let me give you an example. And this is an example that Microsoft Nuance knows very well. I think you're probably familiar with ambient clinical intelligence. It's an ability a person to talk with their clinician. The entire conversation is not only captured, but it's organized into a clinical progress note, and it can be seamlessly integrated into the medical record. amazing, right? Because, and I think a lot of people are thinking that that is a generative AI solution. Well, if we break it down into the steps, the very first step is it identifies who's speaking. And that is not generative AI. That is, I'll call it traditional AI ML. The second part is codifying all the different words. And it's knowing that this is a ICD-10 or SNOMED code that associated with this. And all of that is not generative AI. It is traditional AI ML. Then you get to the note making, which is generative AI. And then it gets to the integration, which is not generative AI. And so Fawad's point about stitching it all together, we realized that we actually had to combine traditional AI ML with generative AI in a workflow compatible way that would allow us to be able to address the overall issue and problem. And I think we're going to see that across again and again. Sometimes we will find that as we break it up, that it will be generative AI, and sometimes it will be other technologies and other approaches. And we have to decide what the right fit is. And even in the generative AI space, we're going to find that while a lot of the focus has been on large language models, we'll have small language models, we'll have medium language models. Some will be focused on specifically a disease condition with all the, you know, the training on it, and others will be based off of larger, more general ones. It will vary depending on the use case. But that said, we are seeing tremendous value with, and it's I think it's surprising that we can actually get very healthcare specific with these very large language models that we're not trained specifically on healthcare. And that has been the surprising thing that I think all of us are starting to uncover.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think the models that we have seen have been very robust in many ways. I mean, more than anything I've seen before. But I think that's also the challenging part, because people start to believe that they're more robust than they actually are, right? They're like my uncle that I have. He's the most confident person in the world, but he's never held a job. Right, so it's one of those situations where the AI comes across so confident that it really knows the thing that you're talking about, and it probably does. It probably knows a couple of inches deep, but it's, you know, a lot of the models, like you said today, are a couple of inches deep and 100 miles wide, and what we need in healthcare is 100 miles deep, perhaps an inch, you know, wide, and I think that's kind of the debate I'm seeing out there. And I'm so glad you used the word small language models, because I am so sick of people talking about the large language models. And small and large are kind of relative. Some are a few hundred million parameters versus some are a few billion parameters. But I do think that small language models are underappreciated, and they will become the holy grail of solving specific tasks in healthcare.
Yeah, I just have to back up. David, I spent 3.5 years at Amazon, and much of that time was in Alexa. We had all kinds of skunkworks projects around trying to deploy Alexa in a medical enterprise, and doing, you know, real time ambient note taking during listening during the patient encounter. And I think it would be helpful for the listeners. I certainly know that I've done this with you in the past in different formats. Maybe just to break down, when you talked about that example, traditional AI or machine learning versus generative. I think we all understand that, but could you just say, like, what is the difference there? Like, right?
Yeah, I think it all starts with the evolution of artificial intelligence. And, you know, having had AI at least coined since the 1950s, we've been exposed to this concept of a machine functioning like a human. But with the combination of machine learning, where it's actually learning from the other data and adjusting and tweaking it ever so slightly, it becomes this what I'll call traditional AI ML, which is very predictive, but it's also very reliable. It's accurate, but it's very dependent on the data set it was trained on. So the one limitation of what I'll call traditional AI ML is that the data set has to be diverse, it has to be large. And if you don't have that, then it's only specific for that. But if you can get a very large, diverse data set, then yes, you have an opportunity to create something that's generalizable. Now, what's interesting is that when we started thinking about how these concepts were interrelated, and then people started saying, well, let's map it out as like a neural network. And then we started thinking about how we could weight different concepts and nodes that were allowing us to be able to then potentially anticipate what that next closest node or that next closest word or pixel or concept was. that's when we started getting into this new space, which is the generative AI space. And that is a different approach. And the reason why it is so extraordinary is because when you have a very knowledgeable or a very large or very comprehensive neural network, and you're going through that, you can extract knowledge from that. And it's mm-hmm. really fascinating how it can find the right way to describe it for you in such a way that you can understand it. Now, that is something that I would say has huge new use cases, but it also has the big limitation that it makes errors. It's not as accurate. It's not reliable as it's reliable. So this whole concept of hallucinations or confabulations has come up, and that's why people are starting to think, well, one, people have said we can't be used in healthcare, which I completely disagree with. I think there's many use cases in healthcare, specifically on the operational administrative side. But there's so many use cases that we can see because there's so many problems in healthcare. And so what we found is that the ability for us to be able to leverage generative AI is something we're just learning now how to apply it in healthcare. So you've got sort of like two paths. I'll call it the traditional AI ML, which is the highly predictive, accurate. You've got the amazing capabilities which come about from generative AI. And now we're starting to realize just how to utilize that. So it's newer. But it's not all a one-size-fits-all. We can't apply the same criteria and the same expectations on both.
Yeah, Fouad, you want anything more you want to clarify? And
a couple of things I would add is I think David's spot on, right? This is an evolutionary process which has been ongoing for at least 20 years. But we were stuck in the ML phase for a really long time. We kept getting better at it. And then we started to build neural networks, and neural networks are kind of like our brains. And the connections there, and they can transverse and talk to each other and figure things out, but they're very limited. They can only know what you teach them. What happened in 2017, I believe, is Google published this paper around transformers. Transformers are a very language specific technology that allows machines and neural networks to predict what the next word would be given the last word and the word before and the context and a lot of the other weights. So that's what's changed. And when it sounds like a pretty simple concept, but human beings really communicate through words. So teaching AI to understand words is a very, very critical capability. So when we did that, some strange things started to happen. One of the strange things that happened was it knew things that we hadn't taught it. Right? And it pretended to know things that we hadn't taught it. But the reality is it didn't know those things. It just knew what the next word was to pretend to be that next. I mean, I go back to my uncle that shouldn't be, that looks very confident. It's kind of like that. But I do think that there's tremendous value in something that understands human language and can predict the answers based on language itself. So I think there's a lot of value there, and that's what we're starting to see happen across
Why don't you guys give a real live example of what a hallucination or a confabulation would look like a real live healthcare example, what for our listeners, because most of the people are out there are like, I totally get generative AI, I've got ChatGPT, it's a new I know how to use the prompt, and it's like I don't even use Google anymore or Bing, I just use ChatGPT to search for things, to summarize things, to write a legal contract so I don't have to hire a lawyer. I mean, lots of consumers today think generative AI, they think ChatGPT, right? And they don't understand, I just put stuff into the prompt and it doesn't come back right. This is off. Is that a hallucination? Like, what is that? These are new fancy words that our listeners don't understand. What does that mean?
Yeah, so Missy, I think one of the things that I think we're now just starting to realize is that how you ask the question is going to determine what you get as the result. So a lot of times people, when they don't get the answer that they're looking for, it's because the way that we communicated it was not in a very precise way that allowed the computer or the algorithm to understand exactly what you were thinking. It can't read your mind. Surprisingly not, it can't read your mind. So what you have to do is you have to be very specific. You have to break it down into different steps. There's a lot of different strategies around how you can do that. Now, sometimes it can come back with a result and you would say, please provide all the references. And you look at all the references and you're like, well, wait a minute, it sounds like this could be it. Then you actually look it up and you realize that There is no reference like that. That's a hallucination. So because a confabulation, because it actually came at with a specific output, and it's not true. In fact, it was completely made up. Now, it's not completely out of the world that, you know, because a lot of these authors, they could potentially have written it, but they just didn't. So that's the type of stuff that you have to tease out. So there's getting the wrong answer, which is not necessarily a hallucination, versus actually reporting something that is wrong. Now, there's another element, which is, you know, when you set these temperature settings, you could set it in such a way that it starts missing stuff. And so, like, there's these omissions, which are also potentially one could consider an error, but that's really due to the fact that you may have set the temperature in a different way. And so I think that there's all these factors that of why people get the answers that they're not looking for, or they're disappointed, or they think it's wrong, or it's incomplete. And so we have to kind of tease out all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I would double click on that as well. For me, hallucinations are at least as I'm getting older, I show up at restaurants with my family and I'm like, haven't we been here before? And they're like, no, we've never been here before. Yeah, that's kind of how I compare LLM hallucinations to, is LLM thinks it knows, and it feels pretty comfortable with it. It looks very familiar, but it isn't. So I think it's kind of that problem. But here's the beauty of it, right? I mean, these are problems that are solvable longer term. The more diversity of content you teach in LLM, the higher likelihood of hallucination is going to happen, right? Because it's going to cross-reference. It might be talking about chemistry and confuse it with something else. But the other thing that comes with it is that you can actually tune these things to be more experimental or less experimental, right? So there are these things called top P's, top K, all these temperature and so forth. And what you're telling the LLM is, like, it's like you could tell your brain, hey, I'm walking into an important meeting. Be extremely tight with your language, right? Only use the words that you know for sure are the right words. And if the right words don't show up, don't say anything, right? It's kind of like that. Versus you can change some of these settings and be like, be wild, see how it goes. And you could ask it, hey, where should I go for a vacation? And it'll say, go to Kathmandu. Instead of saying go to Paris, which is the most likely answer based on searches it's seen in the past. So I think you have the ability to teach the model these things. And I think while we're getting better at teaching the model, I think we still have a lot of work to do on teaching the human on how to use the model and understand that these nuances exist.
So let's talk about data and data procurement and the way in which subject matter experts have to use data, specifically if you're trying to build use cases in healthcare. I think a lot of folks out there are like, oh, well, you know, you can start with a foundation model and then you can sort of add proprietary data to it to refine it and to tune it. So it comes down to, can you find the right data? Are you using just structured data? Or are you adding unstructured data? Is it multimodal? Like, there's all kinds of things here. So maybe just like talk a little bit about how what's your point of view on finding the data? Is it all about having lots of data, or is it about what you do with the data and your subject matter expertise, particularly in healthcare?
Yes. So I would divide that first into, as you're developing the models, there's a certain data set that you need. And you have to think about, like, you know, how you're going to utilize that. To me, that's, I'll call it the first part of the equation. The second part is, after the model has been developed, can you use data to specify how the model will be applied? Something called RAG architecture, where you're grounding the information on these data sets and you're enabling people and organizations to utilize that. To me, that's sort of a different category. So, like, the first one is really around training. You're developing the model, you're training it. And the other one is actually how you're utilizing it with your own specific data. And I think each one of them has a slightly different, you know, kind of a set of requirements and needs and limitations. What we're finding is that if you want to truly kind of go through this whole process, you're going to also need to think about one other element, which is the data that you're, is the algorithm that you're going to test it going to work within your own data set? So like everything what I've described here is now sort of pre-deployment. Now there's this other element of testing it in your own data sets before you actually get it live into production. And then that gets to the whole integrity of your own data sets as opposed to the data for the models itself. And so that's why it's a little complicated. It's not just about, you know, the question is, which phase are you in? What's the purpose? But at the end of the day, data is essential. It has to be clean. It has to be, the way I think about it is like, if you've got an engine, if you've got a car, let's say your LLM or your generative AI is your car, you want it running on high octane gasoline. You don't want to have a lot of impurities in there, because ultimately, if you have that, it's gonna cause a lot of problems. And so the goal is to make sure that you've got a process to make sure you've got purified high octane gasoline or data in your system.
I really love it how you defined it. So I agree with that. I think as we're getting into this new world of LLMs and Gen AI, data is changing. The type of data is going more from structured to unstructured in many ways. The kind of things that we used to look in data are different, right? We used to look for nulls and repetitions, and now we're looking for bias and offendability. So I think there are lots of new things that are happening. So I think of it in inputs and outputs. When your inputs are all the training data that you're putting into the model, and I think there's a rigor that needs to be in place to be able to train the model appropriately. It's like a little child you have, and you're going to teach them a lot of things. You want to make sure that you're teaching them all the right things first, right? The quality of the content that you're using to teach them is of high quality. So I think that's a big space. I think a lot of companies haven't had to think about it in the unstructured world. And in the structured world, you have governance and quality and dimensions and so forth. But I think in this new world, there's people are mostly talking about guardrails, but I think there's a lot more that needs to happen. And then on the output side, I think that's where other challenges come in, right? Where how do we reduce hallucinations by plugging into data that is reliable through RAGs and other components? How do we measure the outputs to make sure that certain things are sensible in terms of what's being displayed and sent out? So I think inputs, what you need to do there is very different than what is happening on the output side, as David mentioned. And these are really open opportunities for entrepreneurs to come and innovate.
Well, and you know, people talk about how models need monitoring and they degrade over time and rules change and data needs to be continually looked at to make sure that it's cleansed for PII and PHI and politeness and, you know, profanity and all of the sort of ways in which our system is biased towards, you know, certain people of socioeconomic status and or people of, you know, racial background. And we have tons of biases in our healthcare data, canonical data today. So what we're sort of getting a little bit to kind of like the regulatory side and, you know, some of the organizations like CHAI, the Coalition of Health AI, which I know David was sort of involved with initially. How are we thinking about model management going forward? How do we, particularly in healthcare, how do we make sure that this data stays fresh and that we're not introducing bias and lots of mistakes?
Look, I have a couple of thoughts on this. I'm happy to jump in first. Look, I think there's a false sense of security in the enterprises today about their understanding of their data. Meaning, you know, I had this debate on LinkedIn a few weeks ago where somebody had posted, well, why do we need to govern data again? It's already governed at the system of record. Why do we need to come up with new things for LLMs? Well, I'll tell you why, because the purpose of the governance at the system of record level was very different. It was being governed for use. It was being governed for duplicates. It was being governed for quality. That meant very, very different things. Now you need to govern it for very, very different purposes. And as such, that attitude and thinking has to change. So I do think that there's room for improvement in this space. And hopefully, you know, some of the founders will come out and build some solutions.
Yeah. So Missy, to your point about, you know, different organizations thinking about this, I think there has been a lot of discussion at so many different levels, government agencies, regulators, healthcare organizations, you know, even, you know, individual stakeholders. And I think what we are now at the point is we have to come to some agreement in terms of what are some of the key principles and guidelines. And we're pretty, I think we've made some good progress. You know, there's the Coalition for Health AI, or CHAI, the National Academy of Medicine has just formed a new group that will be working in collaboration with CHAI to develop some further guidelines and to really refine that. That's, so I'll call like the starting point. We need to kind of agree that AI transparency is important, and here's what it consists of. You know, bias mitigation is important. We need to have equity in terms of how this is governed, and, you know, we need to assess for drift. These are all important concepts. The question then is, how would one do that? And so that's where this other coalition came about, which I've been involved in. It's called the Trustworthy and Responsible AI Network, or TRAIN. And it's really about operationalizing a lot of those key guardrails. And I think in the process of thinking through how one operationalizes it, there's been a few revelations. And so the first revelation is that the way we currently treat AI is very much like traditional software. It goes through a rigorous testing process, it gets FDA cleared, and then we forget about it. And ultimately, that's not going to work for all the reasons that you shared, that we now have to realize that AI goes through a life cycle. And that life cycle means that you have to continuously monitor. And so what's new is we're going to have to do post-deployment monitoring. That's new. Okay, so that's going to be something that we'll have to deal with. The second is that traditionally, the organizations that focus on this are the ones with high levels of resources. You know, you talk about academic medical centers, you're talking about, you know, large health systems that have big teams, but AI needs to be universally applied across the board to everyone. Low resource settings, high resource settings. And if it ends up being that we're following the exact same processes of governance that we've always done in the past, it will not be equitable. And that's why we need to think about how do we automate or semi-automate a lot of the governance processes. The way I think about it is like a washing machine. It needs to go through different cycles. There's the rinse, the spin, the wash, the second rinse, and all this. And AI goes through all these cycles, and we have to predefine success criteria. We need to determine how long it's going to be out there in certain environments. We need to have alerts whether or not it's the washing machine gets jammed or it's overheating. All of that has to be put in place, and that's going to require some level of technology integration into the existing workflows. And that's why this is more than just simply saying, let's just do what we've always been doing. Let's just all agree on these principles and then go at it, because the people that can go at it will be the ones that have the resources. Those that don't will be left behind. And that's why we have to think about inclusion by design.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, I think you have to do that inclusionary work from the beginning, because the needs and the demands for largest payers might be very different than the needs and demands for some of the smallest ones. So I do think that you know, as we think about guardrails, as we think about training data management, as we think about policy and compliance and sensitive data in general, I do think that one size fits all is not going to work, as you said correctly. We need a framework and a tooling that can scale up and down. Something that allows you to start with nothing, without any money, perhaps, and to be able to adopt it, to all the way to enterprise licensing and so forth. So I do think that creates a lot of challenge in an industry which is really kind of, you know, and this is probably the more controversial comment for this, which is that I do think that some of the largest health technology entities are monopolizing a lot of the regulatory conversation. And I understand why, right? Because they have a lot of investment and a stake in it. They also want to take a leadership role. But I think the challenge when you do that is that you get the high-end view for the large and the largest enterprises, and a lot of the small and medium ones get lost. So for me, one of the things that we have to do, you know, better this time is, while the largest players should drive the agenda, but then they should make sure that the smaller players are included throughout that journey.
In other words, include the longer tail. I mean, I did a tour in government during the High Tech Act with David Brailer, the first ONC Office of the National Coordinator. And, you know, we had all of the big EHRs lobbying. We had everybody that was trying to find meaningful use in an HIE platform. And, you know, it was very hard for us to be inclusive. Even thinking about the patient's voice, thinking about all the longer tail sort of startups and or vendors out there. So I think that's a very... being inclusive is very hard at this stage because this is such a new innovative wave. However, I think it's a well taken point. We only have a few minutes left here. I think what I would love to sort of just close with is, where do you think the future is going to go? Fawad, you've talked about this sort of agent framework where you have, like, literally the way that I, in my sort of healthcare AI for dummies speak, that's like a whole bunch of different task-based LLMs smart enough to be able to talk to each other. So it's like, hey, I'm smart. I do this task over here. Now I know how to have to hand it off to you. It's like this entire agent framework. I mean, is that, you know, I know there's been a couple papers published on that. You have some special vocabulary for that, but is that really going to happen? Are we 5 years away from that? Are we 2 years away from that? Like, that's very, like, very, very sci-fi.
It's happening right now. I mean, I predict a healthcare ecosystem, and we can come back and do this in 3 years, where agents are going to be fighting other agents, right? Think of prior authorization for an example. There's going to be an agent on the provider side that that agent's job is to create the best prior authorization request. And there's an agent on the other side, and its job is to, you know, find faults and inefficiencies. So though, I think there's going to be an agent war that happens along the way, and it's kind of happening. The first iteration of it was not Gen AI, but there were lots of NLP models and so forth they were running. So I do think that agents are going to play a big role. And I think agents are, you know, there's workflow components. Obviously, I can do this, you can do this, can we collaborate and do this together? I think there's definitely something there, but I think agents are also interesting because they can allow LLMs and Gen AI to do things that that are different. For example, self-reflection. It's a concept when you put it in the context of AI, you're like, what do you mean AI self-reflecting, LLM self-reflecting? Well, here's an example. You can ask an LLM to create a summary report for a medical paper, for example, and it would create it. But then you have another LLM that reviews the output from that first one, but with the lens on, how could you improve it? What did it get wrong? How, you know, and then taking the output from the second one and feeding it to the first one to rewrite it. Now it's not exactly self-reflection, but I think you can, it's a version of reflection that can be created through agents and through collaboration. Right. So those are the kind of things that I'm super excited about in terms of technology. And I'm also, in terms of areas of focus, I think governance of LLMs in a more holistic fashion beyond just guardrails is an area of opportunity and excitement for entrepreneurs that know what they're doing.
David, close us out. What is that really real? Is that going to happen? What else are you just completely tickled about and you think we're going to be at in 2 years?
I think there's three elements that we need to keep our eyes on: the technology and the process and the people. Within the technology, if you think about what generative AI does extremely well, it allows us to be able to pull data from different sources. It allows us to summarize that into a way that we make sense. And then it presents it in the right format, whether it's in the clinical progress note, into a certain field, whether it's in code, in a language, at the grade level, with empathy. That opens up a lot of categories on the operational side, around patient education, patient engagement. There's so many different things that traditionally we have said only a smart human can solve. We now realize that the computer can do that. That's going to transform a lot of what we can do on the use case side. In parallel with that, we were just talking about this, there has to be governance and guardrails. And we're going to get good progress in that, and we're going to get better understanding. A lot of folks are leaning in. That's going to be fantastic that we when we see those happening in parallel. But the third, which let's not forget about the people. People need to be skilled on how to do this. I was talking to the CEO of a large health system, and he said he had 1,000 clinicians, doctors and nurses that are doing billing and prior authorization type of work. He knows that all of that could be automated. He can't do it, labor unions. Why? Because they need to make sure they have jobs for those people. And it's not the role or the responsibility for a hospital or health system to be able to figure it out, but it is the role and responsibility for all of us to think about as we're moving towards this new generation where people are using AI for higher levels of activity, we have to train them on how to do it. We have to be able to create a path forward. And if we don't do that, then we're stuck where we're at of just people experimenting. And so it's got to be all three of those things running in parallel.
Yeah, so well said. So well said. All right, we are at our time. I could talk to you guys for another 30 to 40 minutes on this topic. It's fantastic having you both as our guests. We look forward to our third episode next month. Thank you again, both to you. And for listeners that want to get in touch with you, we will be able to put your LinkedIns up when we put this episode up. Thanks again, guys. Great to see you.
Great. Thank you.